Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. The NFL draft has finally finished. We are done with the draft cycle. Everyone's drafted a whole bunch of players. Well, except for, I guess, a team or two, which did not have many draft picks. But the draft is over at this point. Most of the undrafted free agents have been signed. The player acquisition window of March and April is basically done as we are here on April 29th, 2019. Today, we are going to sit here and talk about the first round of the NFL draft. And joining me to do that, a friend of the show who is playing through pain today. Someone who suffered, I believe, the only media injury during the NFL draft in Nashville. And that is our friend from CBS. It's Will Brinson. Will, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling, Bill, I'm feeling fine. I'm not going to lie and say I'm feeling wonderful. It is nice to have the draft in the rearview mirror. We can sort of, as NFL analysts, look forward to the future. Unfortunately, my wife is aware that the NFL, you know, like, work is no longer a viable excuse for a lot of things. So a little anxiety on that front. As far as the actual injury is concerned, I am feeling surprisingly great. There's no permanent damage to my face. I'm going to have to figure out how to get these stitches out of my eye. At some point, I'm not really worried about that. We're leaving for Disney World on Monday, so that's exciting. But no ill after effects, no concussion-like symptoms, no upper body injuries outside of just one slice of a thick cut on my eyebrow that apparently is not even going to be noticeable in maybe even as short as a few weeks.
Well, number one, I appreciate you mentioning that you're going to Disney. If this is a Disney podcast, thank you for supporting the mouse.
Well, I'm hoping some shadowy ESPN figure, the boss of yours, will email me like, oh, cool, you want a free fast pass? here, this is for your, hey, we'll set you up on the monthly contractual Barnwell pod, give you one free fast pass to It's a Small World or something.
I have some bad news for you, Will. As the proprietor of the Bill Barnwell Show, has to do a show every week, I don't get a free monthly fast pass, unfortunately. That is a shame. But number two, do you want to get into how you were injured at the NFL draft?
Yeah, so Bird scooters are apparently the primary method of transportation. Lime, Lyft, whatever, you know.
Sure.
They have a million different of them. I don't even know if they're big in D.C. or New York still. I would presume that they are, but
sure.
Nashville is littered with these scooters. I mean, I would say that at any given moment, I can look out my hotel window and spot somewhere between 17 and 50 of them. And it's like 60% Bird scooters, 40% party buses, 30% drunken trolley rides, you know, and then like 1% of the humans are actually walking. Well, I was going to interview Devin White at one of those pre-draft, you know, interview things with like Braun or P&G or Old Spice or somebody. And I got dropped off at 6th Street by the Bridgestone Arena instead of 6th Avenue and needed to get over there in a short span. So instead of walking, it was a little warm. I didn't want to be sweating when I got in there. I grabbed a Bird scooter, ridden it before in Raleigh, in Atlanta at the Super Bowl and feel comfortable on them and took off to the interview. I ride it fine. I get to the interview and then, you know, get done with the interview. It was really crowded down there. So I was trying to get away from the streets that were sort of blocked off and crowded, find an Uber to get back to my work, to see my folks at work. I grabbed another Bird to clear some space. I'm going down a downhill street near there, right near the public library in Nashville. And I see, this car comes flying out to my left out of this parking garage. Oh. I jerk to the right, yell some mean things at him, jerk back to the left to try and to get back on the sidewalk and off the street. And Nashville has a lot of sidewalk ramps that are not congruous with the pavement of the street itself. Oh. There's like a ledge. I didn't realize it. The wheel catches the ledge. It throws me over the scooter. I land on my wrist. I'm trying to save the moneymaker from hitting the pavement. My book bag rolls up over the top of it, and I take a secondary bounce onto the pavement. And at that point, I believe that I smacked my head against the pavement or smacked my sunglasses between the head and the pavement, and it created this giant laceration on my head. And that's where the heavy blood and the stitches came from. Oof.
Did any bachelorette parties witness this?
No, but I did interview multiple bachelorette parties on Friday night, along with my colleague John Breach. Did you see that video that we put out there?
It was wonderful.
hard-hitting journalism. Somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to get up there and take those tequila shots on the party bus with the bachelorette parties. And that also explains why I don't feel fantastic. the bachelorette party buses didn't help. But it ended up working out pretty well. I got stitches and was able to, you know, still go out and create viral video content and do 3 days of NFL draft coverage on CBS Sports HQ and do a podcast every day, the Pick Six podcast that people can subscribe to and download and listen to if they don't feel like, you know, a weekly podcast is enough NFL content. They can go get daily from me as well.
Normally, we would not allow our guest to plug before the plug segment of the show, but you are an exception for playing hurt, Mr. Brinson. We always, of course, appreciate you coming on the show, and I'm happy you are doing relatively well. Obviously not perhaps your usual self in terms of...
Bill, I could be short 2 or 3 teeth based on how I landed. And so that's awesome. I will say it was a little odd. Like I was standing, I gathered my pride and scurried around the corner with the scooter and sort of set it apart and like just trying to like shut it down on the app and didn't really know what I was doing. And I'm gushing blood out of my head. I keep touching it. Both my arms are covered in blood. I finally grabbed a T-shirt an extra T-shirt I had in my bag, thankfully, to you know, hold up against the wound. And like not one person stopped and was like, hey, are you all right? Guy in the street who's bleeding, which I don't know if that says more about humanity or just Nashville as a whole, that they just don't even flinch when a guy's gushing blood in the middle of the street. That part was a little odd, but certainly, it could have been much, much worse.
Well, I mean, I don't want to disparage. I was not in Nashville, so I cannot disparage the people of Nashville. I mean, just based on pure stereotypes, they could have rubbed some hot chicken on it. I don't think you would have appreciated that. A bachelor party could have poured
tequila
on it. It's
possible they were all just drunk. I mean, that's the vibe you get from that city.
Yes. As someone who lived in Las Vegas, I feel like it might be very similar to that vibe of just, I'm going to move on and keep drinking here. But it seems like overall, outside of the injury, it seems like Nashville was a very fun experience for the NFL draft, no?
Yeah, it was awesome. The setup is perfect. It is a party city. I mean, there are tons of bachelorette parties. You could go to all the different sections of town where the draft wasn't, and it was still a raging party throughout most of the week. And you got this vibe, even when you landed, you know, it's like the opposite of the Super Bowl in New York, right? Where you got there and what's Super Bowl? Super Bowl's here. Who cares? Nobody cares. It's New York. Nothing's too big for the city. It was like, oh, cool. Another party. Yeah. Jump on in. The water's feeling fine. Everybody hang out. There was at no point did it feel like anybody was slowing down. We had to re-record a podcast. We had some audio issues that we recorded on Thursday night. And so we had to go over on Friday morning and re-record it. And there were like open air duck boats and open air party barges careening by, blasting music with people like chugging beer at 9 a.m. Central Time. I mean, nobody flinched. I ran into your colleague Trey Wingo at some point in the streets of Nashville, and he's been doing this for a long time. And he remarked how just unbelievable the city was and how great it was. And you know, you could walk everywhere. The weather was nice and warm. The people are friendly. And it all felt like all the energy funneled towards Broadway, where the draft was taking place, and you could sense it in the streets when you were walking around. That just everything was funneling there. So it's hard to explain, but a really, really cool scene.
I mean, I love Nashville. I'm sure it sounds really awesome. Let me ask you this: we'll get to the draft here after this question. Are you willing? No, let me preface this by saying you know where the draft is next year.
Oh yeah.
It isn't. I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Las Vegas, Nevada. Yes. Are you willing to consider a 1 year anniversary parade of bird scooters in Las Vegas that you will lead 1 year from now as a way to show that you are not permanently scarred by your accident in Nashville?
I firmly believe, Bill, that when the Los Angeles Chargers have the 32nd pick in the 2020 NFL draft, that I should be brought on stage with a bird scooter and a Chargers draft hat to announce it. That you don't need LaDainian Tomlinson, you don't need Dan Fouts, you don't need any of these former Chargers legends. You need Will Brinson to celebrate his 1 year anniversary of the bird scooter accident, and to announce the Chargers draft pick after they win the Super Bowl.
I, as one of the primary leaders of the Chargers bandwagon, I think you deserve that. However,
or you, me, Greg Rosenthal, Mike Clay, Mina Kimes, we could get Chargers Hive and all ride a parade of bird scooters onto the draft and announce it in unison.
Just all together as one big bandwagon. All right, well, let's get to talking about Kyler Murray and the rest of the top of the NFL draft in a moment. But first, let's talk about our friends at SeatGeek. And, of course, Will, I'm assuming, is a SeatGeek user. I know myself. Whenever I'm going somewhere, one of the first things I do is I hop on SeatGeek, see if there's any games for the time I'm going to be there, and I go and I purchase tickets for that event on SeatGeek. And the good thing is, I like checking out sports. If you're not a sports fan, I'm a little confused as to why you're listening to the Bill Barnwell Show, which is mostly sports content, but good news is there is stuff that is not sports available on SeatGeek. You can get tickets for comedy. You can get tickets for plays. You can get tickets for concerts. Anything that you need a ticket to get into, you can buy those tickets on SeatGeek. It is a ticket company where the customer comes first with more than 50,000 five-star reviews in the App Store. And yes, I am one of them. SeatGeek is focused on making your experience as easy as possible. They pull in tickets from all over the web, rate each ticket on a scale of 1 to 10, and then display them on an interactive seat map so it's simple to find what you're looking for. Green dots are good, and red dots are bad. So don't buy any of those red dot tickets. Buy a green dot ticket, and you can get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase by going to SeatGeek, either via their app or on SeatGeek.com, and entering in promo code Barnwell at checkout. That's $10 off your first purchase if you do use promo code Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. And you can use that for concert tickets, sports, comedy, whatever you want. That's promo code Barnwell for $10 off your first purchase at SeatGeek today. Now back to the show. The Cardinals bandwagon had a very early pick this year. They had the first overall pick in the NFL draft. And we'll start our coverage there because that was Kyler Murray. And, I mean, obviously there had been a ton of rumors. After the fact, we've seen, I read in Peter King's column this week that even as recently as early April, the Cardinals were not sure who they were going to take with the first overall pick. But it was Kyler Murray. Were you surprised at all it was the actual pick when it happened? And is it the guy you think you would have chosen if you were or Steve Kime and Cliff Kingsbury at number one?
Yeah, it's, how many months of intrigue surrounding this turned out to be just false. You know, any of the buildup turned out to be false. I mean, I would say the intel that Pete Prisco had causing him to believe that it would be somebody other than Kyler Murray was pretty good. And I bought into what my colleague was selling and turned out to be wrong. And I mean, like I have pretty good knowledge of what his intel was. And it was a very viable belief that they were going in a different direction. They ultimately ended up going with Kyler. I am curious as to what percent of the pick was made. And I know that Steve Kime and Cliff Kingsbury spoke openly and candidly with Peter King, and he published that story on Monday. I am curious, Bill, what percentage did ownership matter in this pick? And I think that can be said the same for the Giants, which we'll get to in a minute as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, look, if I get it, I get both sides of this deal. I understand why if you believe Kyler Murray is the quarterback and he is the guy and he is the guy that will make Cliff Kingsbury successful, then you have to go all in on it. You can't take half measures when you make a drastic shift in your coaching staff the way they did to go from Steve Wilkes to Cliff Kingsbury. And so from that perspective, I understand getting Kyler Murray. I do. If you think that he's best fit to run that offense, then you should do it. I actually applaud the Cardinals for getting a second round pick in return for Josh Rosen. I think that was more than what many of us thought they'd be able to get in return. I don't think they handled the process well. I don't think the lead up to it was necessary. Clearly using a top 10 pick on a quarterback 2 years in a row is a bad process. And I think that they really mishandled it in terms of just human being interaction with Josh Rosen. I mean, if they knew all along it was Kyler Murray, they didn't need to tweet out Josh is our guy and do all this yes, subterfuge and all of that. It's a disservice to a guy who handled it in a really classy manner and Josh Rosen. As far as what I would do, I would have preferred the combination of Josh Rosen plus Nick Bosa or Quinnen Williams to the combination of Kyler Murray and Andy Isabella, which is basically what you're talking about. So I would still ride with Rosen, and I'm rooting for the Dolphins now a little bit, but I can see the side of how the Cardinals handled it. And overall, you know, if you're Steve Keim and you're going to do what he did and take Kyler Murray one, you need to back it up with a pretty good draft the rest of the way. And he absolutely knocked it out of the park. Andy Isabella, Hakeem Butler, Byron Murphy, the top of round two, really good job by the Cardinals to inject that offense with a lot of life. It's not hard to imagine. I don't think they'll be the 2017 Rams or 2018 Bears, but I can see them being a lot better than people expect and at least entertaining on offense.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously added some help in the secondary with Murphy. Signed Robert Alford, who I'm skeptical of, but, you know, at least an upgrade on who they had at cornerback across from Patrick Peterson last year. And then, like you mentioned, a bunch of weapons at receiver to play alongside Larry Fitzgerald and Christian Kirk for Cliff Kingsbury in that air raid offense. And I think when it comes to Kyler Murray, whether it was Rosen, whether it was Murray, I think that offense, to your point, is going to be a lot better quicker than other people are suggesting, just because it's not going to be an offense that's going to be built upon complexity. You know, with Kyler Murray, I brought this up when I recorded the YouTube video for ESPN, he doesn't have to learn a 400-page playbook. He doesn't have to learn a 40-page playbook. He has to learn a 40-play playbook. I mean, it really is going to be about, you know, taking simple concepts and dressing them up and making them work. And it's going to play to his strengths. He's not going to be someone who, he doesn't have to be someone who has to learn an enormous playbook. Not that he can't. I'm not saying anything against him as a player, just that, he's not going to have to worry about that sort of complexity early in his career. He's going to be able to sort of, you know, play to his strengths, play to his athleticism, you know, play to, things that people maybe haven't seen before when it comes to that offense. So I think they could be an offense that's better a lot quicker than maybe your typical offense with a rookie quarterback, or even someone like a Baker Mayfield, where he was great. You know, he was really great during the second half of the season after Freddie Kitchens was promoted and they moved on from Todd Haley. He was, you know, decent certainly when he first took over, but was more inconsistent than he was during the second half of the campaign. In terms of Rosen, were you surprised there wasn't more interest than there ended up being from, really, it seemed like just the Dolphins?
Yes, I was. I do think, though, that there were – here's the thing, Bill, and I think when you look at winners and losers of this draft, regardless of – like I, and this is why the Patriots end up with a good grade from basically everybody, is that rounds two and three in this draft were so meaty in terms of talent that was sitting there and available for teams to select, just because it wasn't a top-end draft class. It was a meat and potatoes class with a really thick middle class. And that sounds social studies, but I'm not. There were guys that could have gone fifth overall or 55th overall, and that shouldn't be surprising. And so I think smart teams with a window to win now, like the Chargers and the Patriots and, the Steelers probably weren't looking for a quarterback, but the teams of that ilk were not willing to sacrifice a second or third round pick in order to go get Josh Rosen, because it would mean giving up a player who could be very valuable for them now. But it'd be great to get a franchise quarterback down the road, but this is a guy who had 1 year of damage. You know, there's lots of bad tape of Josh Rosen out there. Sure. And, even if he's dirt cheap, you know, you're in a position where, you know, maybe, you know, you don't know how long Tom Brady and Phillip Rivers are going to play, you know, whoever the quarterback is. So from that perspective, yeah, a little surprising. But, I mean, yeah, I would say, like, Cincinnati should have gone out and given up a third-round pick for him. But it appears, based on, you know, the Dolphins' conversations with Steve Keim, that you would have to give up, you know, a top 50 pick in order to beat out what Miami was offering. So from that perspective, I guess I'm not as surprised. But I would have gone out and given up a third-round pick for Josh Rosen. I think he's a good quarterback. I think he had a bad rap last year, and I think he could bounce back. And, man, I mean, if you can land a top-10 quarterback talent with a third-round pick, that's how you change a franchise.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. For the Dolphins, I wrote this up a little bit for ESPN, like, worst-case scenario, not worst-case, but pretty much the worst-case scenario is he's okay, he's a backup. And if he's a competent backup, if he's even a mediocre backup, he's still a profitable player for your team, because he's only making about $2 million a year for the next 3 years in a league where, you know, good backups are making $5-6 million a year. So, you know, obviously the upside is there. And if he turns out to be a starting quarterback, well, you found one of the biggest bargains in football. And I think it's a great move for the Dolphins. I think it's very low risk. You know, you want to have a second round pick, but they did trade down, did, you know, sort of manufacture an extra pick out of that with the Saints. So I think it was a great move for Miami. Even if it doesn't work out, I think the logic going into it, given their situation, given what they're likely to do in 2019, given that it doesn't preclude you from drafting a quarterback in 2020 whatsoever, if Josh Rosen is not your guy, I think it's an absolutely slam dunk, no risk, easy decision for Miami. I will
say this too. I think it is interesting to at least look at the time. We won't know anything for a couple of years, mm-hmm. but at least next year we'll have an idea of how some of these guys might be. Just some names that went in that similar range. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned, you know, the depth of this. I mean, Paris Campbell, wide receiver at Ohio State, 59 sure. to the Colts. Nasir Adderley, safety out of Delaware, 60 to the Chargers. Taylor Rapp, safety out of Washington, 61 to the Rams. Andy Isabella, wide receiver out of UMass. Juan Thornhill, safety out of UVA. DK Metcalf, wide receiver out of Ole Miss. That finishes up the third round. All of those guys at one point in time, by one of the 50 billion mock drafts out there, was projected as a potential first round pick. So sure. I really think you have to tip your cap to the Cardinals for somehow getting this decent yes. pick out of this when they so badly bungled the leverage and the negotiations here.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the rest of the draft, let's get to number four, because 2 and 3 pretty much chalk, you know, pretty much what we were expecting or close to what we were expecting. Raiders at 4. Of course, there were rumors before the draft. They were kicking their scouts out. They didn't want to reveal their secret plan for the fourth pick. And then it was Clelin Ferrell, despite the fact that there was the Michael Silver story that Mike Mayock ran a mock draft exercise with the Raiders before the draft and moved down to 13 and still managed to get Ferrell. The Raiders were not willing to wait. And I think we've heard about this with quarterbacks. We're going to get to it with the Giants and Daniel Jones. A little different with pass rushers, especially in this draft. And it is hard to believe that they couldn't find a way down from 4 and ended up going for a guy who I think is pretty good, but not necessarily someone who would have come off the board in the top 5 in most anyone's mock draft.
I like how the guy who went to Northeastern pronounces it correctly, and the guy from the South who like spent 4 years watching Clelin Ferrell. I can't help it. I call him Clelin Ferrell. I'd be curious, by the way, Bill. I sort of thought about after my scooter accident, mm-hmm. like acting like there was some sort of like brain injury that caused my accent to change. Like, you know, when Homer gets the crayon stuck up his nose and he turns into a genius. Like, I was thinking about going just like full Southern. Like, just I'll do all interviews like this. I hit my head on a scooter and started talking like a hayseed and just seeing how my football writing career would pivot. I think it would pivot poorly, but that's how bad of a headspace I was in. Yeah, I mean, Ferrell at 4 was a stunner, and right. it didn't last long as a stunner because of another pick we'll get to mm-hmm. in a second. But to have the Raiders with Josh Allen on the board, a player that a ton of teams liked, T.J. Hockenson sitting there, Ed Oliver, even Devin. I thought Devin White. He told me before during our interview that he believed he was definitely in play for the Raiders. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to judge this because, as you point out, the Raiders did a mock exercise and they traded down and he was there for them later. Mm-hmm. So it makes you wonder, why would you not move down, try to accrue some more picks, try to get better value out of where you pick Ferrell, and not worry about it. Like, I feel fairly confident they could have moved down to 8, 9, or 10 and still gotten him. But mm-hmm. I also understand that, and like we heard rumors, the Bills were trying to get up to get at Oliver. So you couldn't have swapped 4 and 9 with the Bills, gotten an extra pick, let them take Oliver, and then you get Ferrell at 9. I think it would have been surprising if Ferrell went before that, given what we saw from the Giants, Jaguars, and Lions in terms of how they address people. Like, you know what I mean? So I don't like it from that perspective. I do understand the concept of, hey, this is where we're picking. It's hard to move down. There don't seem to be a lot of options for us anywhere. This is the best guy on our board. Let's take him. I get that. I just wonder, you know, I heard Brian McFadden mention this on our CBS Sports HQ show, and I don't know if it was out somewhere else, but apparently the Raiders liked Ferrell's maturity because they're going to Vegas. Well, that's something.
Sure.
I mean, he's more mature. I guess that's good. I mean, I think he's going to be a great locker room leader. I think he'll be an impact player. But if they take him at four and Devin White, Josh Allen, and Ed Oliver are all much better, this is going to look like a very foolish draft pick.
I do find it interesting that, not to disparage John Gruden, because I, you know, he was a former colleague. I have nothing against John Gruden, but I do find it funny that the guy who was the star of multiple commercials with Hooters is like, oh, we got to get the mature pick for our move to Vegas here at four. I agree with you. You know, I do think that they could have moved down. Buffalo certainly seems like they were interested in moving up. The Giants, you would figure, given that they were in a panic, you probably could have convinced them that someone was going to trade up with the Bucks, so that they had an offer at four, and that if they wanted to get their guy, they needed to trade up for a quarterback. But they didn't, of course, ended up taking Daniel Jones in six, which we'll get to in a second. The Raiders, I feel like we're getting a sense of what John Gruden wants to do with this roster now. We've seen him through two free agency periods, and we've seen him through two drafts now, and really the second draft made things crystal clear. He wants guys who have prototypical size and prototypical bodies for their positions. You look at the guys they've added over the last 2 years. Last year it was the two offensive linemen, Colton Miller and Brandon Parker, both of whom are 6'7" or taller. They drafted They signed Trent Brown in free agency, who is 6'8", I believe, left tackle. Tyrell Williams is 6'4". One of their big free agent signings. And granted, Antonio Brown is smaller, but Antonio Brown is still Antonio Brown. You make exceptions for a guy like Antonio Brown. Clelin Ferrell has prototypical size. Josh Jacobs is not enormous, but for a halfback, he is just about where you would hope for in terms of size. Trayvon Mullen is 6'1". Jonathan Abram, again, not quite as big. And I think there are going to be exceptions here or there, but mostly it seems like he is going for guys who have, you know, the sort of typical size you'd want from a guy at a particular position, even if they don't have the high upside, even if they don't have the same talent or the same consistency that you get from players who are shorter. And it seems like John Gruden's basically betting on himself to coach these guys into really talented football players, given that they have the sort of, you know, physical attributes you can't teach.
Yeah. It's also like, it's weird because I have a hard time sitting back here and believing that if Mike Mayock, and maybe I'm wrong, I mean, I don't know. We never saw his player evaluation list for the 2019 NFL draft. But do we think that Clelin Ferrell, however pronounced it, was the number four player on his board, or even the number three player on his board? I don't know. I just have a hard time based on what we know about Mike Mayock and how he's built his boards out. He doesn't cater, you know, never catered to, you know, the homogenous draft, you know, whatever, you know, the sheep that often run in draft circles. I mean, he did his own thing. I just have a hard time seeing him putting him above Josh Allen because of the upside and all that. But I mean, yeah, maybe he was there. I mean, this is a draft where there were potentially one or two guys. I mean, Quentin Williams and Nick Bosa that were above everybody else. And then it's all sort of a mishmash there. And in that regard, it could make a lot of sense. I feel like there had to have been a lot of input from Paul Gunther here in terms of a guy, you know, getting a guy that he wanted and a guy that would work in his defensive scheme, which, you know, was probably passed on to, to John Gruden, which was then probably passed on to Mike Mayock. And so I this whole process, Bill, has me sort of wondering who is, you know, what is the exact way that this is laid out. For instance, you know, again, you read that Peter King article, and he talks about when the Eagles traded up to get Andre Dillard late in the first round and snipe the Texans. Well, Mike Mayock thought, yelled a cuss word, moment of panic, the Eagles jumped us for our guy. And it's like, well, why is he, first of all, Mike, why are you freaking out about a running back getting taken in the first round? But to read it, it was like Gruden had told Mayock not to screw up the first round, and you know, and he's like, wait a minute, John, I think it's about the tackle. And it almost seems like there's a bit of a, like, I'm sure they trust each other, but then, like, Gruden sort of turned this over to Mayock, but Mayock was scared to maybe do something that Gruden didn't like in terms of how he approached the draft. Like, he had to cater his draft to Gruden rather than catering his draft to his big board. And that's where I sort of wonder about the selections by the Raiders here.
Yeah, I think we're still figuring out how much of this is John Gruden and how much of this is Mike Mayock. And I think the Raiders perhaps are still figuring out which is which and how much each guy is going to have a say in terms of their draft selection process. We're going to hit a break, come back and talk about one of the New York teams. I'm not sure which one. Depends on who had a more interesting draft here on the Bill Barnwell Show in a moment. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN, joined by CBS's Will Brinson. Let's get to it, Will. I'm not thrilled to have this conversation. I have not been looking forward to it. Let's talk about the Giants. Let's talk about what they did in this draft, and let's start with Daniel Jones with the sixth overall pick. What was your immediate reaction when the Giants made this selection?
Well, there's no way that I can say it on air, Bill. I mean, it was a what the bleep moment. I didn't have the same reaction as your colleague and our friend Mina Kimes, who no doubt played it up for the cameras, really yucking it up to try and go viral. I get it. No, I'm just kidding. Mina, I saw that clip. It was wildly entertaining. It was shocking. I mean, period. End of the story. It was shocking to see that the Giants do that. You know, I believe that someone, maybe Daniel Jeremiah, mocked, you know, Daniel Jones to the Giants at six at one point in the process. I don't know if he had that in his final mock. Mm-hmm. I would guess that he didn't because it's not believable enough, especially, you know, even with the benefit of hindsight, you know, you look at how this draft unfolded. I have a hard time believing that Daniel Jones wasn't going to be there at 17. Right. I know that Dave Gettleman loves Dexter Lawrence. I mocked Dexter Lawrence to the Giants in January and never moved off of it, and it was right the entire time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a Dave Gettleman pick. I do wonder if this sixth overall pick wasn't sort of an ownership pick. And, you know, again, we see it with Dave Gettleman. I think part of the problem, we talked about it last year, right? I mean, he does the whole keyboard thing, take Saquon too. And then he comes out, he's like, maybe Eli will sit 3 years. Maybe 2 years. Maybe I'll get hit my car. Who knows? I don't know. And it's just the way that he approaches this.
Yes.
It's fine when you're winning. You can sort of get away with that like he did in Carolina and maybe a smaller market. It's less so fine when your team is terrible and you're in New York where you're being asked these questions repeatedly. And it just feels like everybody's piling on this, which is usually it's either a sign that it's going to go really horribly wrong or everyone else is going to look stupid. I mean, if Daniel Jones is great, then this is an incredible draft class by David Gettleman.
Right.
And if Daniel Jones is not good or even just average, then this is going to get Dave Gettleman fired. I don't think there's any two ways about that.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I think it's tough when you have someone who is swearing up and down that Eli Manning is still great and still just as good as he used to be. And that person is the one who's saying, well, just trust my instincts. I know best. I watched this guy at the Senior Bowl. And that was when I knew he was going to be our pick. It would be easier. And I think to his benefit, if he was just like, you know, we evaluated all the guys. We think this is someone who, you know, throughout the entire process, watching his tape over the last couple, like lie. If you're going to talk about this and you don't want to get, you know, berated in the media, just lie. Just be like, hey, it wasn't the Senior Bowl. It was over the course of the last couple of years. We thought he was our guy. That's fine. No one's going to get upset with you for that. You might get upset for other reasons, granted, but, no one's going to critique your process, even if it perhaps should be critiqued, which I think pretty clearly it should be. The thing I would say is this. You mentioned this a little bit with Kyler Murray with the first pick. I really can't be too upset about taking a quarterback earlier than you think he should be taken. If you think he is a franchise quarterback, and the Giants do, I would take him six. Even if I think there's a shot I would get him at 17, I would be willing to do that for someone like a Farrell, someone like a Dexter Lawrence. I would have, you know, considered trading down and getting him with my, you know, later in the first round. I would have waited for 24 or 25 because I think that's a different position. But if you think you have a franchise quarterback and he's on the board at six, even if you're not sure the Broncos are interested at 10, which they're saying no, they might have been, I think, given that they took Drew Lock, they're not going to say that. Washington, I assume they were going to take Dwayne Haskins. There were some reports before the draft they were interested in Daniel Jones as well. Who knows what they would have actually done? But I'm not horrified, because if he works out, there's no problem taking him at six. And I think if he doesn't work out, and they have no quarterback for another year, I think there's a good chance Dave Gettleman is either fired or in serious jeopardy this time next year. So I can't fault them for doing it where they did it, but I just don't think there's a lot of evidence that Daniel Jones is a very promising NFL prospect. No.
Exactly. And, like, I mean, I don't think that you can definitively say that Daniel Jones is going to be better than Ryan Finley, who the Bengals took in the fourth round. I mean, they played same conference, you know, same area near where I live. You could watch Daniel Jones and think, all right, you know, this guy's got a shot. But it really feels like so much of what went into this is, I hope I'm wrong. It sounds so stupid, but this guy played for David Cutcliffe, just like Eli Manning. And he went to Duke, and he's a prototypical cerebral quarterback who can handle the limelight. And he and Eli will get along because they were coached by the same guy. And look at all the success Cutcliffe quarterbacks have had. Well, no, the Mannings have had success.
Right.
And Peyton Manning had a ton of success, and Eli was along for two Super Bowl rides and made a couple big throws. I mean, Ryan Wilson, my colleague, asked me this on the podcast, and I think the answer is yes, but I'm going to ask you the same question. If you could have, and it's tough, I think, to even ask it, but like, if you would have Eli's career, not counting the Super Bowls, would you take him sixth overall in this draft? You would, right?
I mean, like, it's not a slam dunk. If it's Philip Rivers or if it's Ben Roethlisberger, take them sixth, no question. Eli, it's not quite as clear. I think I would just because he was so healthy. You know, he was pretty good for a long time. He was never, you know, a top three or four quarterback. Maybe there was a year where he was a top five quarterback, but I don't know if that's necessarily, like, maybe 08. But, you know, he was pretty consistently somewhere in the 10 to 16 range, which is valuable, in itself. I don't know that's necessarily, you know, worth what they've paid him necessarily, but I do think, you know, I think if you can say, okay, we're going to get 14 years or 15 years out of pretty good quarterback play, I think you take that. I think that's worth the sixth pick, but again, it's not a slam dunk. And that's, you know, that might be the best case for Daniel Jones, is that he's decent to pretty good for a while.
Yeah, exactly. And like, that's not what you want in the sixth pick. And I know that this is a weird draft because we didn't think there were a ton of transcendent players, but I mean, I do wonder if Josh Allen, TJ, to me, when you go and look on the Wikipedia pages of drafts, and there's the person's Excel cell, the cell has no color. It's white, right? And it's, that means that person was probably a bad draft pick because they didn't get the blue or orange labels.
Yep.
And if there's a bunch of people who got the blue and orange labels below them, that means things have gone very wrong for the team that drafted the guy who lacks the pigments in there. It feels like Daniel Jones with Josh Allen, T.J. Hockenson, Ed Oliver, Devin Bush, and Jonah Williams immediately after him could be that way, especially if this harebrained plan to sit him for 3 years, which I don't think Dave Gettleman is serious about, but which he did reference in his post-draft press conference, were to come to fruition. Imagine drafting a quarterback number six overall and not using, actively choosing to not use 3/5 of his rookie deal, especially when that fifth year you only utilize after you use the first 4 years to determine whether or not the guy is the guy. I mean, imagine sitting him for 2 or 3 years after taking him sixth overall.
So what you're saying, he's basically the Jake Locker of this draft.
I mean, that went poorly for me in an old takes exposed way, but it does feel like Jake Locker, Christian Ponder, Blaine Gabbert, it felt like this was a class like that where, you know, there were some, you know, I don't know, like, I mean, Haskins fell, I guess, so maybe not. But, yeah, I mean, Daniel Jones feels like one of those guys where you took him in a spot that could potentially backfire for everybody really badly. Look, at the end of the day, I mean, it's a pretty simple equation. If Daniel Jones is a franchise quarterback, then Dave Gettleman can laugh in all our faces. And if he's not, and this doesn't work, we probably won't get the laugh in Dave Gettleman's face because he'll have been fired a few years before.
Yes. I mean, they've cast the future for the franchise. There's no like, oh, well, when are we going to make the decision? They've made the decision. So this is the team they're going to build.
It's like the opposite of the Josh Rosen gambit, right? Like, you trade for Josh Rosen and you're like, well, this guy has top 10 upside. And if it doesn't work out, nobody's going to blame us because we didn't spend much on him. And we're allowed to do whatever we want in terms of drafting another quarterback. And the Giants would have had that opportunity if they traded for Josh Rosen. If you draft Daniel Jones sixth, and it's just the matter of your investment here as well as the psychology of all of it. You draft him sixth, and you're tying yourself to this kid and you better be right or else everybody gets fired.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, it could work out. There's a lot of talent on this offense. Saquon Barkley, Evan Engram, Golden Tate, Sterling Shepard. The offensive line is much improved. Still not great, but, you know, Nate Solder, Will Hernandez, Kevin Zeitler, pretty good core for your offensive line. I just, you know, this is a team that you'd figure they're going to be trying to win games, running the football with Barkley and playing great defense. And that worked in Carolina with Cam, where they had, you know, a guy who was a much better quarterback than I think people give him credit for, but had a very good running game with Cam being a huge chunk of it and a very good defense. I don't know that even after using first round picks on Dexter Lawrence and DeAndre Baker, nothing against them, but I don't know that this defense is really very good given, you know, the guys we're seeing on paper here.
I don't think it's great either. And you also have to answer the question, hey, what'd you get in return for Odell Beckham? Oh, okay. Dexter Lawrence and Jabril Peppers. And who's the other guy that his name is?
O'Shane Jimenez?
Yeah, good for you. I actually, Ryan Wilson had to teach me how to say his name 7 times on the podcast today. but yeah, I mean, I think taking Josh Allen 6th overall maybe doesn't fix the defense. I just felt like they were going to go just load up on defensive players, maybe try and make a little bit of a run this year using Eli. And it just feels like everything good that the Giants did with this draft is all outweighed by the criticism and the concerns about Daniel Jones 6th overall.
Mm-hmm. So moving on, in terms of Josh Allen, just mentioned, do you like the Jags taking him 7, even though, I mean, the strength of their team was already pretty clearly their defensive line?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. I think that's a guy. And I know that they were considering Ed Oliver in that spot too. Mm-hmm. It worked out for them because they later got Juwan Taylor, that one of the offensive linemen that they thought they might target in the first round. Yep. at 7th overall. They got him in the 2nd round, so that was a nice little pull by them too. You know, I don't think that their needs necessarily matched up with the way that this draft board fell. You could make a case for T.J. Hawkinson there instead of Josh Allen, but I think Josh Allen was so high on their board. And additionally, you know, you can't always just draft, as you know, Bill, you can't just draft for need. Sure. You know, there's a chance that, that they're going to struggle to work out contract situations with Calais Campbell, Marcel Darius, Yannick Ngakoue, all those mm-hmm. guys. And so to add another defensive pass rusher to that group and maybe a guy who can be a little bit more, malleable in terms of where he lines up as a pass rusher in Josh Allen, I don't mind it. I think that sometimes it's okay to double down on strength, and the Jaguars did that with another pass rusher.
Yeah, I mean, look at Tom Coughlin. Think about how he won his Super Bowls.
Yep.
Great, great defensive lines, multiple talents, guys who were lining up inside, outside, and you know, drafting defensive linemen when there were needs elsewhere on the roster, saying, okay, if we can just rush the quarterback, we don't have to worry about other spots on our roster. We don't have to have a great quarterback with Eli Manning. We don't have to have a great running game. We can sort of make it work with a dominant defense, and they did. So I don't blame them. I think it's a... You know, it's leverage against possibly Yannick Ngakoue if they decide that they don't want to give him a big deal and want to trade him, which I don't think they should. But, you know, having Josh Allen as your third pass rusher, as someone who's going to kick inside or kick a linebacker or, you know, play all over the field, if you have a creative defensive coordinator, you can do a lot of things with Josh Allen. And I think he offers them, you know, a really good chance at having a dominant pass rush again, which they had in 2017. And that was really what drove them into the postseason. I like a lot of the draft picks here in this range. I don't have any issues with really any of them. T.J. Hawkinson, I love going to the Lions at 8. You know, Ed Oliver going to the Bills, I think everyone loves at 9. They didn't have to trade up and get him. Steelers traded up to get Devin Bush at 10, a pick that I think everyone is a big fan of. I believe we're about to have a dog drinking water here on the show. Yep, Jonah Williams. Yeah, classic Maggie running. Perfect time for her to be thirsty. Jonah Williams at 11, again, you know, right in line with what I think people were expecting for the Bengals. Upgrade on Bobby Hart, who they gave a very curious contract to. Rashawn Gary seemed like he was a bit of a surprise for the Packers at 12.
I don't like the move. The players, he's very talented. He has a ton of upside. Didn't produce much at Michigan. There's some concerns. Maybe he was misused in Jim Harbaugh's defense. That seems a little weird to me. Like, we know that Jim Harbaugh got a lot out of his players at the pro level and has done a good job at the college level, despite the narratives that he should have a hot seat. And the bigger thing is that shoulder surgery. We saw this with Shaq Lawson most recently. You just drafted a guy who has a torn labrum and might need surgery now. The buzz was that he can, quote unquote, manage it during the season. That's not how a torn labrum works. You can't manage that. And so to take a pass rusher at 12 who's an athletic guy with not a ton of college production, who might need shoulder surgery before, and if not before, then definitely after the draft. I don't know if I love that, especially when you compare it with the Dolphins going Christian Wilkins next, with a high upside, high floor guy coming from Clemson with a ton of production at the college level and a locker room leader type of guy.
Yeah, I mean, Rashawn Gary really has to work out for this pick to work, and this is a team that, of course, spent so much money on Preston Smith and Za'Darius Smith in free agency that it's not, you know, they might sit there and say, okay, we're going to put Rashawn Gary on the shelf for the first year and let him go get labrum surgery, and they might not have a choice, of course, but just a move that I don't, you know, just didn't seem to add up. And traded up for Darnell Savage later on. This just seems like it's a Packers team that's, you know, really, it's almost like they are the teenagers who just left Ted Thompson's house and they're like, we're going to do whatever we want now. And it's a little strange. That doesn't mean it doesn't work. It doesn't mean it's not going to work out, but it's just, it's very jarring.
It's also weird to me that they're like, they're clearly all in on this year and making Matt LaFleur work out of the gate. And, you know, they come away with Dexter Williams as the only running back they added to Aaron Jones and Jamal Williams, who's a sixth-round pick. They did get Jay Sternberger, so I credit them for that. That was a, you know, move that a lot of people thought the Patriots might do, is pass the tight ends in the first round, take Sternberger later. They got him in the third round, which is a nice pick. Added Elgton Jenkins in the second round to beef up the offensive line. But, I mean, we're going to need to see a pretty big step from one or two of Geronimo Allison, Marquez Valdes-Scantling, and Equanimee Estate Brown, in order for this Packers offense, I think, to really be dynamic, because they just don't have a ton outside of Devontae Adams. And with Jimmy Graham getting older, you can put a lot of pressure on Aaron Rodgers here. Mm-hmm. If the offense isn't great, people are going to question the coaching moves.
Yeah, or question Aaron Rodgers, it seems like. Yeah. One or the other could happen. It seems weird to say, given the reports before the draft, that Washington was Daniel Snyder was taking over the draft room and they were going to do something stupid. And then they came away with Dwayne Haskins and Montez Sweat in the first round, with only having to give up a second-round pick in 2020 to get there. It does seem like this was a pretty smart turn. Even if it doesn't work out, it seems like the Washington got two really talented players at reasonable positions in the first round without having to give up too much. Is that strange? Is it strange to compliment Washington for doing something smart?
It is. This is sort of like when I text my wife and be like, hey, I'm going to Vegas for the weekend, and I'm actually going to leave on Wednesday, and every guy that is my friend that you don't like and like parties really hard is coming with us, and she's like melting down for 48 hours, and then I'm like, oh, I'm just kidding. I'm going to go to my buddy Carr's house for the night and like hang out and watch the game. She's like, oh, my God, go ahead. Have fun. Here, can I buy you some beer? Have a blast. The scenario that was leaked out about what the Redskins might do was so bad and so terrifying for Redskins fans that when Daniel Snyder just sat there at 15, took Dwayne Haskins, and then just get, and by the way, that future 2020 second round pick is probably going to be a top 40 pick. I don't think the Redskins are going to be great. So it'll probably be a pretty valuable asset. But if that's, you know, it doesn't hurt you now. It's a psychological factor, right? And so I think Redskins fans were able to embrace it. But, yeah, I mean, they did a good job. It felt like instead of Daniel Snyder just taking over the draft and bending it to his will, that there was a compromise with the coaching staff and the front office and the owner, where he said, look, I want this Haskins kid. And they said, all right, if he falls to us, we will take him at 15. And they said, we need some defensive help. And they were willing to trade back in and give up that pick. And, you know, Chris Ballard's always willing to trade out. And so, you know, you get a guy with the heart issue, but he has the upside to be a really great pass rusher. And, you know, if Darius Geis or Bryce Love or one of these ACL-ridden guys for Washington in the run game can come along, and that offensive line can stay a little bit healthier this year, it's not inconceivable that Washington could win, you know, 7, 8, 9 games and challenge in that division.
Sure, of course not. Absolutely not. Not in, you know, hardly out of the question. It's not exactly that that's a dominant division. I mean, the Cowboys should take a step backwards this year, given how good they were in close games. The Eagles, I mean, you know, a very good roster. I'm excited by their draft, but of course still, you know, one Carson Wentz injury away.
Yeah, let's see 16 games from Carson Wentz, right?
Exactly. You know, certainly the Giants, I'm not high on, to put it nicely, but, you know, division that's always up for grabs every year, even though it seems like we're not expecting it to be. So I can't fault them. I mean, if it doesn't work out, doesn't work out, but if you could have told me this was going to happen, you know, this time last week, I think not only Washington fans would have signed up for it, but I would have signed up for it. I would have said, hey, that's a smart move. All right, well, let's get to the bottom half of the first round here. But first, want to talk about our friends at Dollar Shave Club. And I'm very lazy, guys. I do not like going out. I have to work a bunch. I really enjoy not having to go to the store. I don't want to have to wait in line. I don't want to have to sit there and guess as to whether something is going to be of good quality, if it's going to look good, if it's going to smell good, if it's going to feel good. I don't have to worry about that with our friends at Dollar Shave Club, because Dollar Shave Club delivers everything I need right to my door, and they keep me fully stocked, so whatever I end up getting, I don't run out of it. That is very important when it comes to toothpaste, because if you wake up in the morning and you have a little bit of toothpaste, you kind of figure, okay, I'm going to squeeze the last little bit out of this toothpaste tube. And then if you're stuck, that one morning you don't have toothpaste, you have to walk out, your breath smells gross, you don't want to interact with anybody, you have to go to a store in like the middle of the workday, it's going to be crowded, you're not going to be thrilled, you're in the bathroom at your office trying to brush your teeth. It just looks strange. You just don't want to be in that situation. You want to know in your heart that toothpaste is going to be there ready for you to use in the tube in your bathroom. And with Dollar Shave Club shipping toothpaste to your house on a regular basis, you are not going to run out. You're going to get it exactly as much as you need it, and you're going to feel safe and secure that every morning you can walk out and go on the subway or talk to people and not worry about grossing them out with your horrible breath. Because you're not going to have horrible breath. You're going to have great peppermint-flavored breath, as I do each and every day, because I use Dollar Shave Club's products. And with their handsome discount, the more you buy of Dollar Shave Club's toothpaste and any of their other products, the more you save. And right now, they've got a bunch of starter sets you can try for just $5, like their Oral Care Kit, which features that very toothpaste that I just mentioned. And after that, the restock box ships regularly sized products at regular price. So what are you waiting for? Get your starter set for just $5 right now at dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. My last name, that's dollarshaveclub.com/Barnwell. Now back to the show. In terms of the bottom half of the first round, anyone who comes to mind for you is like a really good fit where you really enjoyed where they came down in terms of matchup of player and situation?
Yeah, I think that, a couple of things I'll point out really quickly that just spring to mind at the bottom half of the round is, one, what a dagger for the Texans to be sitting there at 23 and you're thinking, holy cow. We have just watched no offensive linemen go early. We are about to land the best pass protector in this class, a guy with 90 billion pass reps because of that Mike Leach offense and Andre Dillard. Mm-hmm. And then Howie Roseman leapfrogs you to 22 and takes the offensive lineman that you knew you wanted. I think that's an absolutely perfect fit, too, for the Eagles because, mm-hmm. You have the Jason Peters situation, and now, in theory, you can get one more year out of Jason Peters. Mm-hmm. Maybe he stays healthy. If he does, great. Andre Dillard can be depth and another option elsewhere on the line. You're locked in with Lane Johnson there on the right side, the 2013 first rounder. And if Peters gets hurt, you have some insurance in terms of Dillard. You don't have to worry about putting Hailai. Do they still actually even have? Yeah, they still got Hala on there. Yeah, Hala Vitae. Yeah. And so, from that perspective, I think you're setting yourself up. We always talk about a bridge to the future for quarterbacks. Well, mm-hmm. the Eagles are trying to build a bridge to the future for left tackle, and that's not a terrible move. I think Marquise Brown to the Ravens, first wide receiver off the board at 25, which is crazy. They have a really young wide receiver group in Baltimore. It was the worst going into the draft, Bill, and now they add of course Brown and then pick up who's the Notre Dame kid. Miles Boykin. And I like Brown's fit because I think he can work well with Lamar Jackson's skill set. He can mm-hmm. use screens and short area passes to improve the completion percentage. And he's a home run hitter out of those spots. And then he mm-hmm. can also blow the top off the defense. And Lamar Jackson has a really strong arm. So from that perspective, I like the fit, although I wonder how good that offense will actually end up being.
Yeah, I think it's good for the Ravens. Not maybe ideal for Hollywood Brown's fantasy opportunities.
Oh, no. Total dagger for him, but yeah, good. It's good match for the Ravens, but he might have, I don't know, 35 catches for 790 yards and five long touchdowns or something like that. Yes. This year.
flip side of that, and I think I'm going to finish up here in terms of what I think, maybe not the best fit in terms of player, because wide receivers on this team seem to wash out pretty frequently for as far as draft picks go, but obviously a dream fantasy scenario is N'Keal Harry going to the Patriots, no?
Yeah, I mean, he could be the Patriots' leading receiver this year, to be perfectly honest. I mean,
right.
I don't, you know, Julian Edelman is the guy for Tom Brady, but he is what Julian Edelman is, and that's a change mover. He's underneath guy. Demaryius Thomas, I don't think is guaranteed to make the team at all. Philip Dorsett is really more of that explosive guy down the field, and after that, it's Bruce Ellington, Maurice Harris, and Matthew Slater and Braxton Berrios. So, I mean, N'Keal Harry could be a guy who comes in from day one, especially with Austin Seferian Jenkins filling in for Gronk, and N'Keal Harry, you know, just schemed up by Josh McDaniels to be a big-bodied point of attack guy who tries to take balls the distance. I'm maybe a little surprised that the Patriots didn't add more wide receivers in this draft, and when they had a chance to get so many of them. I do think, though, Bill, when you look at how they handled this pick at 32, that, and I said this a couple times leading on Thursday night, is that I think Bill Belichick was there at 32. He probably had offers to trade down. There were a lot, you know, Drew Locke is still on the board, a bunch of people still on the board. And he realized that given where the Patriots were in the second round, I think it was 56 at the time, that there was a very good chance there would be a ton of receivers taken given how the board had fallen between 32 and 56. And as a result, he decided to pull the trigger on the guy who was on the top of his board, and he ended up being right. I think there were 12 receivers taken in the second round alone. You know, this is where the receivers all went. And so, you know, he was able to get his top choice there outside of Hollywood Brown. And I, you know, it's just one of those where maybe I don't love it, but you got to trust the Belichick evaluation.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to sort of stick your trust where it doesn't work out. Hey, you know, at least that was on Bill Belichick's side of things as opposed to the way around. Will, if people want to check out more of the, voluminous, I think is the word I would use. I'm not sure if that's an actual correct word, but certainly exhaustive draft coverage from you on CBS over the past week. Where are the various places they can go do that?
Yeah, we got winners and losers all week long on CBSSports.com. The Pick 6 podcast, as I mentioned before, in my non-sanctioned plug of my podcast, is on iTunes and Spotify, Stitcher, and all those great places. It's a daily NFL show up every single morning around by 8 a.m. for your commute or gym trip or whatever you do. Actually, it's usually about like 6 or 7 a.m. And it is it will be daily through the off season somehow. You have to get used to some new voices next week because I'll be, like I said, hanging with Mr. Mouse down in Disney World, at Will Brinson on Twitter, and at Will Brinson on my newly verified Instagram page.
New verified on Instagram? Man.
My wife is so mad about it. She's like, I have more followers than you do. Whatever. Like, okay, cool.
All right. Well, Will, it's always a pleasure. Please heal up in time for your monthly appearance in May, but so happy to have you on the show.
Will do, Bill. Oh, by the way, I want to point out one more thing. Jacoby Myers, out of NC State, the Patriots signed him as an undrafted free agent. He's a big-bodied slot guy who could be a real difference maker for that offense. It got me that absolute steal where they got him. I wouldn't be surprised if he is an impact player next year. So
UDFA sleeper.
Cool. Yeah, there you go.
All right, thanks so much to Will Brinson, one of our favorites. Always happy to have Will on the show. And if you're looking for more NFL draft content, this week on the Mina Kime Show featuring Lenny, Mina is back from Nashville and still dumbfounded by the Giants' decision to draft Daniel Jones with the 6th pick. She is joined by Mike Golic Jr. to recap the weekend of steals and reaches and to decide whether or not real swag is no swag. Very interesting topic there. Download and subscribe to the Mina Kime Show featuring Lenny on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're going to come back next week, I think, talking a little more draft stuff, maybe some more analytics when it comes to the draft side of things, but more NFL stuff on the way. Thanks so much for listening. Back next week on the Bill Barnwell Show.